hearing from the construction claims, the construction board, their legislative concepts, as well as discussing some questions regarding local enforcement of non-licensed contractors. We also have the Department of Agriculture here to discuss any questions the committee has about labeling issues. And, of course, when the other members get here, we'll share legislative concepts and for the committee to discuss and to request drafting of committee bills.
Okay. And do we have any particular order that we would like to start with?
I guess Craig's here. We could start with him.
All right. Why don't we go ahead and start with CCB. Craig Smith, if you'll please come forward and we'll get started.
Thank you, Senator Pruszanski, Chair Pruszanski. Craig Smith, Contractors Board. I'm here to talk to you today very briefly about the Task Force on Construction Claims and the progress that they're making. As you know, they're meeting nearly every month at this point. Their work is progressing. They're currently not prepared to provide detailed explanations of what's going on with the recommendations. Those should be forthcoming. I don't staff that task force. Mark Long should be able to provide you with further information perhaps next month.
Okay. I understand we may have someone coming in a little bit. Ms. Brickman's supposed to be coming in and maybe giving us some type of an overview as to what they, where they're at, but I appreciate your candidness as to where things are at. So I guess we can just move on into the stuff that you wanted, that you were requested to talk about, and also the stuff you'd like to share with us on the concepts.
All right, very good. One of the issues that is very important right now is the state of the CCB enforcement program. We've received some complaints regarding the amount of patrol out there in the field. We have a program that the Assembly authorized over the last 15 years. We call it the Regional Investigator Program. This is a program where we divided the state into 12 regions, basically by population and geographic location. And we contracted with private investigator businesses to provide a measure of local enforcement for CCB regulations. That program has worked over the last several years. It's over the last couple of years, there have been some program issues with the program. There has been some performance issues, and we've run into some trouble regarding the issue of independent contractor. We have a past vendor who has filed for unemployment compensation, and we have some litigation involved with that matter as well. As a result, these contracts, which expired on July 1st, 06, have not been relet. We're working with Department of Justice, Employment Division, and others in an effort to handle the performance issues as well as the independent contractor issues, make sure that we have a good program that works. We have not let a new RFP since that time. I'm not entirely confident that we will ultimately let an RFP for that program, but it's still possible. In the interim, what we have done is to redirect resources. You know, we have about 60 staff at CCB divided fairly evenly between the three major programs, which is the licensing, enforcement, and contract dispute resolution. We've moved an additional two employees out of dispute resolution and hired compliance officers that will help us with our enforcement efforts in the field. We have six current. That'll bring a total of eight compliance officers together with some support staff. The other thing that we're doing over the course of the last several months are sweeps in regions. So we have recently got back just from Central Oregon over the last week working with our sister agencies in employment and revenue. We've been to Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon coast, and other places where the whole idea is to go spend a week concentrating on the construction activity in that area and try to saturate the construction industry so we can get some compliance. Those have been moderately successful. They don't replace a person in a local jurisdiction, but in order to have a person in a local jurisdiction, we may need additional resources.
Can you tell the committee the number of, let's say, contractors you had under previous contracts that were doing this? Because what I'm hearing is that some areas had someone, let's say, there in that region to handle any complaints that came in. Now you're looking at kind of a spot enforcement based on the lack of resources that the department currently has available to it.
Senator Pastransky and members of the committee, we had 12 regions, approximately six vendors were filling those 12 contracts. One vendor had several contracts. That vendor had employees that it used to try to service the different regional areas, but 12 different regions, six different vendors. These were not full-time jobs, but they certainly were effective at least providing a appearance of a deterrent, and to some degree actually finding non-licensed or illegal contracting activity. The other thing that I'm prepared to talk about today is the Construction Contractors Board legislative agenda. I've passed out the single piece of paper. You should have a copy of it. And what I'd like to do is talk very briefly about these concepts. These have not been ultimately approved of by the administration, and that's yet to be done. We'll see how that goes. But these have been authorized for drafting purposes. The way this chart is designed, it shows, of course, a legislative concept number. If you do see an LC number, that means that the concept's been drafted. The description is there, and then on the far right-hand side is an indication as to whether or not the concept is designed to service only the residential industry. Commercial industry has different needs. Starting from the bottom very quickly, we need to look at a possible removal or heightening of the cap on the cost of a home inspector test. $50 is really not adequate to have a proper testing program. There's some question as to whether or not, on the next one, on number 19, whether or not the agency currently has the ability to charge a fee for certified home inspectors. That was just apparently left out of the legislation. We can charge for a renewal, but we can't charge for the initial certification. At least arguably we can't. We want to make sure that you want that done. There are some housekeeping issues. I won't bore you with those unless you have questions on those. The next one has to do with government efficiency or improvements. There currently is a program that has to do with lead-based paint. And, of course, lead-based paint is a danger in the environment. We try to make sure that people that deal with that abate lead-based paint and other types of activities are properly educated for that work. There are about 55 persons that have a certification to operate in that discipline. They have a dual requirement, one that they get their education from one agency, and then they come over to our agency and have a license requirement. That seems to be unnecessary. We've talked with Department of Human Services, to see if this would be a decent proposal, and we believe that it is.
So just for clarification on that, that would mean that the Department of Human Services would continue to do the education. Someone completing that successfully then would be able to get certified through that agency?
That's correct.
Just to follow up, they would not need to have a CCB license?
If Senator Pastransky and Senator Starr, they probably would, if they had a business that did the work, they'd have to have a business license with CCB, but they wouldn't have to have a second license with CCB certifying that they have the training. That would be all through the other agency. Yeah. One of the problems we have right now, and this has to do with concept number 14, is the revocation of a contractor's license. If we take a contractor's license away today, the law doesn't prevent that contractor from reapplying the very next day and getting their license. And for some activity, fraud, dishonest activity, failure to pay a construction debt, some other things, we believe that we ought to have a discussion about having a set period of time where that person is unable to get a license. In other states, it's 1 or 2 years, maybe as much as 5 years. We'd like to bring that before you.
That concept seems similar to like in driving while suspended, where you'd have a length of time that would be prescribed based on whatever the type of violation. So you would have that. I mean, there's three different types of driving while suspended: violation, non-criminal, and then the misdemeanor, and then also felony. So maybe looking at that type of concept.
I think
more
that
serious stuff would be a longer period of time?
Yes. Now moving up to legislative concept number 13, minimum contract standards and model contract for residential construction contracts. This is an idea that we think has come to today. You have to have a written contract if you do contracting work over $2,000, but there's no standards in the construction law regarding what needs to be in that contract. Landscape law, there is such standards. I think that the construction industry is ready for some minimum standards that would perhaps dictate that the parties' names have to be on the contract. The price or compensation needs to be in the contract. Perhaps a completion date. We'd like to see you authorize the contractor's board to establish this by rule so that any of these types of restrictions would be done in the light of day through rulemaking.
Question. Mm-hmm. How many of these items have been vetted with the industry?
Okay. Senator Przanski and Senator Starr, these items have been discussed with both the remodelers and the home builders. I haven't got their complete buy-in. We're going to continue to work with them to see if they're interested in these matters. I can't tell you, though, that they've signed on to them.
Thank you.
Another concept is some form of model or recommended contract. We could probably do this today without statutory authority. We think that it would be a benefit if you would direct the Construction Contractors Board to produce such a contract. I can tell you that most of the contract disputes that we have are because there's either no contract or the contract that does exist is not read by the parties or is not readable. In some cases, it's a handwritten document that the consumer doesn't know what it says. In other cases, the contract is so voluminous that, again, the consumer doesn't know what it says. And we'd like to work with both the construction industry and perhaps folks on the consumer side to see if we can't, as a state, come up with something that would be recommended for parties to use. Number 12 has to do with DMV Pictures. I talked a little bit about that the last time I was here. We've withdrawn that proposal. Now is not the time to talk about DMV Pictures being accessed by CCB. Perhaps that's something that you could talk about on a broader spectrum at a later date. Number 11, require contractors to notify the CCB if they file bankruptcy. Bankruptcy filings are perhaps the most difficult issue that we have to deal with on the consumer side, and we believe it makes some sense for industry to let us know if they're going through that procedure. Advise of court judgments and arbitration awards, number 10. This is the concept that has to do with letting the Construction Contractors Board know if there is a judgment out there that's unpaid for a particular length of time so that the agency can consider some form of discipline if the debt doesn't get paid. Number 9, require contractors to notify the CCB in the event that they lose their insurance coverage. This seems like kind of a no-brainer, but we were not able to come up with a system where insurance companies would notify the agency if the insurance isn't in full force and effect. Unlike bonding companies who do so, we've found several cases where a consumer has been damaged because there is no liability insurance. The contractor provided evidence that it had liability insurance at the beginning of its licensure, but at some point during the period of time of its licensure, it lost its insurance. The insurance companies, again, are not required to let us know, and the consumer in some cases were not put on notice by CCB's website that the insurance wasn't there. And so we think that we ought to put this burden on the back of a contractor. If they don't have insurance, they ought to tell the licensing agency.
Would that concept require the company providing the insurance to give notice that they've canceled?
Senator Przanski, the Concept would not. It would put the burden on the back of the contractor. We worked with the insurance division and other insurance professionals to see if we could put this on the provider of the insurance. Many of the insurance providers are out of state as part of the problem, and we could not come up with a recommendation sufficient for drafting purposes that would put this on the back of the insurance companies.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't be looking at putting it on their back, but if they had canceled insurance, it seems like that there would be maybe some means of, if they're giving the insurers notice, that that notice could also be forwarded to a state agency.
Sure.
So, I mean, at least that's something that may want to consider.
Okay.
If it sounds like maybe it's been considered at some point, but because, I mean, if you got someone that has their insurance canceled and they choose not to report that, then I guess you're looking at some point, someone potentially being harmed before it's corrected, and then what are going to be the ramifications for that. And it may not be quite as safe. I mean, it seems to me that by the committee or by the board getting this information up on the website, you may be able to note something. So if a consumer's looking at whether or not they want to enter into a contract with someone, and if they don't meet the minimums of having that insurance that's required, then that would give notice to that consumer before they enter that contract.
Absolutely. And of course, the other thing is that's a prerequisite to licensure. If we learn that there is no insurance, we'll immediately suspend the license.
Okay. Well, that's even that's more important, because that would show that the status of not being properly licensed in the state.
And Senator Przanski and members of the committee, I would be remiss if I didn't follow this up with saying that there remains contractors who notify us that their cost and availability of insurance is prohibitive, and they tell us in no uncertain terms that our requirement of insurance is driving them out of business. Now, I should also tell you that I think that has lessened over the last year, but nevertheless, we still get those complaints. Number 8 requires all business entities to notify the agency when the ownership changes. And you'd think this would be kind of dispute, but currently, if there's a corporation that's licensed, the law does require that the agency learn of a change in ownership. But LLCs, we don't have a similar law. So if there's a limited liability company, and we've had a couple of cases where we have had limited liability companies that frankly brought on new members who had been revoked by the agency or had lost their license through suspension, these were bad actors, and unfortunately, there was no requirement on the part of the company to let us know. I think that the individuals in this case I'm thinking of didn't realize that the partners that he was bringing on were rather unsavory, but the long and the short of it was, he brought them in. Those two bad actors ran the company into the ground along with about 12 consumers. And if there had been a requirement that the LLC notify us in the event it changed members, we might have been able to put the main principle on notice that you can't have these two persons involved with your business, and here's why, at the very least.
Would that fit in with your concept 14 in the sense of that minimum time limit for revocation?
Senator Przanski, I believe it would.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that we've done over the last several years is to require a certain amount of business competency. You have a test, you have some education, and of course that can't be taken by a corporation or an LLC. It's got to be taken by some human being. And we call the person who takes the test the responsible managing individual. And that's long for RMI. But right now, the RMI, there's no requirement that the RMI for most businesses run the business or manage the business. And again, to be very frank with you, we've had some situations where we believe the RMI, even though it's an owner or corporate officer or member, has little to do with the business. And we'd like to have a discussion about requiring the person who takes the test having some management responsibility for the business. You know, the lien law, this is number 6, is particularly problematic for consumers. It's a controversial issue. The pay twice issue is what we're talking about. We have perennially approached the assembly about this problem. 20 years ago, we discussed it, and we came up with a notice requirement. That notice requirement provides a mandate on the part of the contractor to tell the consumer when it enters into a contract of $1,000 or more, provide them with a notice that says, here's what happens if you pay me and I don't pay my subs or suppliers. One of the problems is that notice isn't read. You know, we require a lot of notices, and sometimes the notices aren't read. We think that it's time to have another discussion, if possible, to put this matter to bed, and that would be to have a solution wherein if the consumer has paid the general in full, that subs and suppliers would not have lien rights against that property, that the subs and suppliers would need to go after the general contractor. That's a huge change in policy. It will be controversial if it even sees the light of day. I can't tell you that it's the, again, a solution that will be well embraced by all, but we think that it makes a lot of sense.
Chris Fault is if the lien notice isn't read.
Yeah. You know, I think that Senator Pernansky and Senator Starr, I think the consumer bears a large amount of responsibility to read the notices that are provided. The government has responsibility, CCB has responsibility to write it in a manner that it's read. And then the contractor has responsibility to make sure that it's delivered in a timely manner. The answer, short answer, sir, is that the consumer is responsible for reading it.
Mr. Chair, that $1,000 limit, has that been adjusted for inflation at all?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Starr, it has not been adjusted for inflation since, I believe, it was 1983.
Mr. Chair, just personal note, I mean, as a former contractor and somebody who provided notice and the lien notice when we had the contract, I know on numerous occasions, and it drove me absolutely nuts, that the homeowner would write a joint check. And it would cause me having to, you know, chase down extra people to get an extra signature so that I can go. But at the end of the day, the consumer was protected. And, you know, I don't know if that's something that ought to, you know, could be as a solution to the consumer, encouraging the joint check. It drives the contractors nuts. They hate it. No, I did. But it's a way for the consumer to be protected.
Yeah.
And I'm going to follow up. I don't disagree with that. I think that's an alternative to what's being proposed. I mean, personally, I think that if I'm entering a contract with a general and the general goes out and gets subs, I mean, in one case, I may not even know those subs are even working unless there's some duty on the part of the general to let the homeowner know that they brought in subs to do whatever work they're going to do. In my contract, as far as, you know, as a consumer, I would think is between me and the general. So I can see validity as to that. You know, the liability is there, and then for the subs, you know, you're working for the general, and you better make sure you got a good relationship with them. They're not going to, quote, run off with the money. But as an alternative, you could actually have some type of requirement that mandates the general to identify the subs that are on the job and then actually require checks and payments to be made to both. I think that'd be a heck of a hassle for everyone, but I mean, that's one way that consumer gets protected. And so I mean, it seems like it's those are two means of maybe addressing that issue.
Senator Prusansky, Senator Starr, of course, that is one of the solutions that's in the notice that goes out to consumers to suggest that. Yeah. An alternative to address the same problem is suggested in number 5, and that is we believe that, although we don't have great evidence on this, we believe that in some cases, maybe many, that information notice isn't being given out to consumers. And we've had anecdotal evidence from plaintiff attorneys that suggest that they never see them when they're suing contractors. They just don't see them, and they suggest that in most cases they're not given out. Hard for us to tell for sure. When we do have a situation where there is an allegation that it hasn't been given out, it's up to the state to prove it wasn't given out, and we usually end up in a hearing where the contractor says, I gave it, and the consumer says, no, you didn't. And of course, it's our obligation to prove that it wasn't. It's very difficult to prove a negative. So we'd like to make it a little easier on the state, if possible, and to require contractors to keep a copy of that document signed. There's a place to, for it to be signed, and if there was a requirement that it be kept, and if it wasn't kept, then there perhaps could be a presumption that it wasn't provided. There also could be civil penalties if it wasn't kept. We think that that would encourage compliance with that law.
I guess my perspective on that is that I can see if you want them to actually require them to have it, then you'd want to have the sanctions for them not having it. I think for the perspective of where there's a he said, she said allegations as to whether it was or wasn't given out, then instead it should be that if the contractor can't prove it, the presumption is it didn't happen. So their bookkeeping would be on the hook, as compared to the state being in a position that they have to disprove the negative.
Okay. There is a second notice that is actually would be better termed a first notice. It's called the consumer notice, and this is the notice that is prepared by the Construction Contractors Board. It describes a little bit about the law that protects consumers, a little bit about the law that regulates contractors, and it's required to be given at the time of a bid. It's a single piece of paper. It's difficult to get all the meaningful information on one side of an 8x11 piece of paper, but that's what the law requires. There is also no place to, we could probably change the notice, but there's no place currently to show a signature, and although it's required to be given, there is no obligation on the part of the contractor to keep a signed copy. We think we should have a discussion about whether or not it's advisable to have the contractor obligated to keep a signed copy. That would be issue number one. And if you wanted to go further than that, and the board suggests that you do, you could have as a penalty, besides just a civil penalty for failure to maintain a copy of this important document, the ability of a consumer to have twice the normal length of time to file a claim with the contractor's board. Currently, the time period is 1 year, and you could have, as a consequence for failing to give that notice, and of course that notice tells a consumer, or should tell a consumer, that it has only 1 year. Otherwise, how would the consumer know they have only 1 year? As a consequence for failing to give that out, extend that period to 2 years. We'd like to talk to you about that. Item number two is a recovery fund. If I could go quickly up to item number one, the more traditional security for consumers is the surety bond. The surety bond for contractors today, a general contractor, is $15,000, specialty contractor is $10,000, and then the handyman or the limited contractors is a $5,000 bond. We'd like to recommend that you consider raising all those bond levels up $5,000, so it would be $10,000, $15,000, and $20,000. We don't think that the cost borne by the contractors would be very high. We think it's been about 5, 6, 7 years since we've raised that amount. We think that incremental raising of the bond makes a lot of sense. Now, today, we have about $2 million, about $3 million of consumer damages were adjudicated last year. About $1 million of that was paid by either the contractor or the surety. $2 million was not. So last fiscal year, ending 6/30/06, we had about $2 million shortfall for consumers, and that's a lot of pain for consumers. And I think the good contractors don't like that either. The question is how to fix that. Now, we could triple the size of the bond, and there's a lot of problems with that, and it wouldn't do a whole lot of good, according to our estimates. An alternative is some form of recovery fund. A recovery fund is just basically it's a government fund. The question is, where does the money come from that backs up the bond or the contractor's promise to pay? So first we'd order the contractor to pay. If the contractor didn't pay, we'd order the bond company to pay, and if the bond didn't pay, then the recovery fund could come to bear. And of course, the big issues is, where does the money come from, and then how much money is available to each consumer, and what is the cap per contractor because one contractor could wipe out the entire fund if you didn't have some form of cap. Now, what we're suggesting at this point is the possibility of using civil penalty money. We assess about $1 million a year against construction contractors in the way of fines. We collect about 20%, 25%, 30%, so about $250,000 per year is what we collect. That money currently goes to the general fund. 80% of it does, 20% is kept for collections. We'd like to suggest to you that we use the entire amount that we collect, and we have a rather robust collection procedure, including agency, Department of Revenue, and private collections. All that money put into a recovery fund for consumers where the bond didn't cover the debt. Then the question is, if you chose to do that, what's the cap per consumer? The cap per consumer could be anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000. We're working on those numbers, trying to figure out what works best. And then, of course, the cap per contractor, we think somewhere between $100,000 to $300,000. So that's recovery fund. Controversial. We also could tax residential contractors or have them pay a fee. Some suggest that a small fee would not be prohibited. Others suggest that further taxing or putting a fee on good contractors who don't cause a problem, now is not the time to do that. That's why we really like the idea of using the civil penalties. The problem is that money currently goes to the general fund, and there will be competition, or there will be a hesitance to use that money for other purposes.
Okay. Questions on that?
I'm going to just give you my insight. I think the alternative of using the civil penalty is the way I would direct your thoughts, or hopefully. I have a real hard time thinking that we got legitimate good contractors basically funding and paying into a fund that's going to be paying for their colleagues who are not working at the standard that we want. And knowing that there's all these other additional costs, such as just having insurance, that's just another burden. So that's kind of where I would be leaning as a as an individual member.
So that concludes the discussion I have regarding the legislative concepts. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any other questions?
Kurt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I think we're going to have Ms. Brickman next, but
Judith, is Ms. Brickman next? Or do we have someone else that we need to hear from regarding CCB?
Mr. Chair, if you would entertain, the chairman of the task force is available by phone at this moment. So okay. If you wanted to patch him in, Eric Grassberger with Sol Reeves, he is the chairman of the task force, and Tamara's also here to sit at the table as well. We're going to patch him in now.
Okay. While we're getting set up, I'm going to make an opportunity, I think, at the end of our hearing, if there are people in the audience that want to give us some comment as to things that we should maybe be thinking about, I'm more than willing to do that if time permits. And the goal is that we'll have one more meeting where we'll actually be introducing
Rick Grassberger.
The concepts.
Mr. Grassberger, this is Judith Counts with the Senate Consumer Protection Committee. If you are available at this time, the committee would be happy to hear your comments regarding the Construction Claims Task Force deliberations.
Good morning. I'd be happy to participate.
Good morning, Mr. Grassberger. My name is Floyd Przanski. I'm the chair of the committee. You have we have at the dais Senator Starr as well as Senator Metzger. And before we get started, I'm going to go ahead and call us into order as a full committee. And Mr. Grassberger, if you'd like to go ahead and proceed, we also have Tamara Rickman, who's here. Maybe she's going to start with an intro. I think she's going to start, and then we'll get you plugged in as quick as we can. And I want to thank you now for taking the time. I know you have a very busy schedule to meet with us by phone.
Thank you. I'm only sorry I couldn't be there in person.
Tamara?
For the record, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Tamara Brickman, and I manage legislative and public affairs for the Oregon Building Codes Division. And just a little caveat that I've been at the Building Codes Division for just a little over 2 months, so if I can't answer all of your questions I'd be happy to make sure to get all of your questions answered.
And before we go any further, Mr. Grassberger, are you having any difficulty hearing Ms. Brickman testify?
It's just a little light on the volume. If there's anything you can do to increase it, that would be appreciated.
We'll try our best. And if you do if you're not hearing what's being said and you need clarification, or please let us know and we'll make sure you get that.
I will do so.
I'm here today for Mark Long, who apologizes for not being able to be here, but he had previously scheduled meetings that he could not change. So I'm here for him. And just to give you a little bit of background about the Construction Claims Task Force, I'm sure you've heard the background before, that the task force was created in the 2005 legislature, and it's been seen as a unique opportunity to basically study and address issues that relate to building codes, construction contractors, insurance, and energy issues all at the same time. And the final report of the task force will be delivered to the legislature in January of this coming January. The task force process has involved some substantial public input and involvement, inviting public testimony. There's a website that has a substantial amount of information that's posted to it on a routine basis, explaining what the task force has discussed, posting testimony. Over 300 people have signed up on the website notification for automatic notification on Construction Claims Task Force information, and as of this point, there have been about 330 submissions to the website. The task force has operated on a phase level, so they've got three phases to this to their work. The first phase dealt with construction defects. The second phase, which they're still in and haven't come to any final recommendations on, are the insurance phase. And then phase three is the actual drafting and approval of the legislative report. The September meeting that we had up this last September, I think it was September 19th, they began a discussion of the construction defect recommendations that they want to put forward into the report. They got through three recommendations, and so they have several more to discuss, and they didn't even begin a conversation in its entirety of the insurance issues that they're going to be looking at. We have a meeting at the end of this month to continue the discussion on insurance issues and also construction defects with respect to forwarding the proposals and deciding what proposals will be included in the report to the legislature. And in November and December, the staff at the Building Codes hopes to be working on drafting and finalizing the report so that it's ready to release to you in January. So I just wanted to briefly let you know what you have up there. You have a background piece of information that looks like has the Oregon logo on it, and it is that's the background on the task force. And on the back of that are the agenda and the timeline and what's happened and what will be happening at future meetings. I think Judith may have provided this preliminary draft of the executive summary of the report to you. I've also provided you with a slide that was a set of slides that was presented to the task force in, I believe it was the August meeting, from insurance folks who had been commissioned to do a study on what the cause of losses and the location of defects tend to be. And if you want to take a look at them, the 78% of the cause of loss in construction defect claims come from water intrusion. And then the location of the defect for that water the water intrusion actually comes from the envelope of the building. And then the last slide shows you what type of housing were finding the defects in, in doing their study, they found the defects in. And then the last piece that you have is it's a concept piece that brings together the entire discussion that's taken place thus far in the task force together in a big concept idea, so you can see how all the ideas fit together and what area of the construction arena they fall under. So you have building code, design, permits, envelope construction, enforcement, and all of the discussions that have taken place in there to get down towards what the task force is going to be recommending for consumer protection purposes. So, and I understand, Mr. Chair, that you wanted to just briefly run through the recommendations. Is that correct?
Yeah, we really kind of want to know what the status is for where the task force is, because, you know, the committee's been monitoring, following, and hoping that, let's say, resolution can come through this process. But if not, then there's a possibility that the committee may be looking at legislation that would be necessary, and also working with the task force and making certain whatever is recommended has an opportunity to get into the process.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. The task force, again, is I had mentioned that they are currently still in and hoping to wrap up phase two within the October and November meetings as far as the recommendations on the insurance proposal side. With respect to the construction defect side on phase one, they have finalized their conversations about what they want to look at for inclusion in the report, but they haven't voted on all of the proposals. So there are seven proposals that they're looking at, they're considering in the phase one with respect to construction defects. They voted on three at the last meeting in September and will continue the discussion of the next four proposals under the phase one the phase one issues to decide what should be included in the final legislative report, and then they will move on to the final discussion hopefully in November on the insurance proposals, with again the goal of having the final report to you in January with the recommendations of the task force. And so, for example, at the September meeting, they discussed and voted on, with respect to include in the report, a concept that deals with CCB licensing and enforcement changes. And they also discussed a building code amendment proposal that they're going to put forward, and a recovery fund proposal that they're going to move forward. And they discussed specifics of what they want to see in each of those particular proposals. And then they have four more yet to discuss at our meeting in October at the end of this month, which involve consumer information, residential permits. They have some proposals around residential permits. They have a proposal that deals with building envelope certification and training for people who do envelope work. And then they also have a proposal that they're going to discuss on building envelope design as it relates to the designers, all designers. So those are the four proposals that they have yet to finalize as to the direction exactly they want, how they want it exactly mentioned in the report.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
It does, to a point. I have a follow-up, but at the same time, I want to make certain Mr. Grassberger has an opportunity mm-hmm. to give his comments, and that might flesh out some of the stuff. I guess what I want you to be thinking about is when are these concepts actually going to move forward to drafting? Are there placeholders now, or is this something that we're going to wait until after the session begins, and once the presentation is made, that the drafting would start at that point? I'm trying to figure out timing. As to, I mean, we've got all these great ideas that's been worked on, making sure we have sufficient time to actually have the legislature take them up.
Senator Chair Przanski, we do have a placeholder for the concepts. There is a deadline with the placeholder, so November 5th, I think it's November 15th, to make sure that we have the placeholder in. So to be very frank with you at this point, if the task force does not finalize all the recommendations, I do not know, and Mark Long would be able to probably answer this question, and I can get back to you later today, what the next step would be, whether it would then need to be delivered to a committee for a committee to introduce the legislation, individual legislators want to take it up. I'm not certain how that's going to work, given where we are in the process.
All right,
if I may interject here, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
What we have done, what staff has done, frankly, an excellent job of, is drafting concept papers that in a fair amount of detail provide what the task force thinks in each of these seven principal areas, and they will do the same for the insurance areas that we call phase two of our analysis. understand, because I haven't directly participated in from beginning to end, the drafting of actual legislation, actual statutory language before. But what we are doing is, through staff and through our discussions and voting at the task force, being as particular as we can be about what we think needs to be done in the state of Oregon. But it was my understanding that the actual drafting of the bills themselves would be done by legislative committee, not our task force.
Mr. Asperger, that's correct. All drafting is going to be done, no matter who introduces it, through the legislative council. They are kind of our legalese and putting everything in bill form and making sure we cross the T's and dot the I's. And then, just for your information, my committee will be meeting one more time where we will be introducing legislation. It more than likely, based on the schedule that you have for your committee or task force, will be after that meeting. I expect it will be after speaking to members. It will probably be sometime in late November or sometime in early December, depending on availability of everyone. So that will be an option for moving stuff forward. If the let's say the placeholder isn't able to be filled adequately or with everything else that you may want.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, with respect to this placeholder issue, I'm not quite sure what that means, but I and I know the rest of the task force members are committed to getting through the issues that we have narrowed down our focus on right now. And I can tell from the way staff has responded to our voting that I really can't imagine that we would miss a deadline, for lack of a better term, that would get the work we've been doing to you or to wherever it needs to be on time. So I don't, if we need to meet more often or extend our meetings, which we've done several times and will do next week, by a couple of extra hours, that's what we intend to do.
That sounds great. And just for information, the placeholder is just an opportunity to really just reserve a spot for legislation so the legislative council knows that there's something coming down the pipe. They're working it in their schedule so they would be able to actually get the drafting done based on certain time frames or timelines being met, because they are, as I said, they are drafting all legislation for the 2007 session, and so they have, let's say, a lot of requests, and we need to make certain that we do whatever we can timely. So I really appreciate the efforts that you and your committee are putting forward. Ms. Brickman, if you don't have anything else at this point, I'm going to ask Mr. Grassberger if there's anything he'd like to compliment in the testimony that you've given.
Mr. Chair, I have nothing else unless you have questions.
Okay. Mr. Grassberger, you've heard, I think, hopefully pretty much what has been already put on the record. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with us today?
I suppose you might be interested in the following. I think that both the gift and, to some extent, the curse of our task force is that all members are vocal. All members have a lot of ideas, and I think that means that what we're coming up with has been turned inside out several times, considered by all sectors of the industry, because the task force has a spread of industry interest on it. And I like to think that anything we as a task force can agree on, I would sure hope would pass the muster of any other interested parties once we turn this into draft legislation. So I think the reason we have a lot of things on our plate and the reason we are working overtime is a compliment to our group, to our task force, and I like to think that it will in the end result in good legislation that will go through, I'm keeping my fingers crossed, without huge objections by any sector of the industry. And of course that remains to be seen, but that's my hope.
And that sounds good. First, welcome to the legislative process. And secondly, it sounds like y'all are working what I would consider, within quotes, a nonpartisan perspective when you have that many different interest groups within the industry trying to come to consensus. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Any questions or comments from the committee? Mr. Grassberger, if there's not anything else, thank you very much for your time. We'll let you continue with your day.
Thank you very much.
And if there's no other questions, Ms. Berkman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to move into another area, and this is going to be one involving the water, bottled water. And so, Mr. McKay, I believe you're here. Please come up, and if you have anyone else that you'd like to bring with you, feel free to do so. And there was a handout, I believe, which has the certs for federal regulations.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Ron McKay. I'm the administrator of the Food Safety Division at the Oregon Department of Agriculture.
And I guess are you here because we've asked you to be here?
Yes, sir.
All
I'd
right.
be happy to answer any questions you have or attempt to about the bottled water program.
Okay. Maybe I should start off since it's kind of one that's been brought to my attention through some constituents, and you were here last time when we had, the time before I guess it was, when we had some discussions about it. I guess I had not had a chance to get through the material that was put on our desk this morning, but on the bottled water, I understand that there are certain federal rules regarding labeling, and my concern is I want to make certain that a consumer, when they go into a retail operation to get a bottle of water, they know what they're getting as compared to what they may think they're getting based on what the name of the company may be and such. And I understand that there are some federal rules already in place. Maybe if you would walk us through part of that. And then I had a couple of questions based on my quick review of the first page of the document that you provided us.
Yes, sir. Senator Pergrancy, basically the Code of Federal Regulations has been adopted by the Department of Agriculture for the enforcement of bottled water. In those regulations, it defines what bottled water or drinking water is. Then it goes further and says if certain requirements are met, you may call it other names. The other names might be something such as spring water, distilled water, artesian water. There are definitions and standards that each mineral water that each of these must meet. If it meets those standards, then it can be called that. But the standard, the overriding name, is bottled water or drinking water.
All right. So my understanding is that there are already some requirements. If you're getting water from the municipality, and it's basically just pulling out tap water, can you walk us through as to what's actually on the label as to for a consumer who wants to be conscious as to whether they want to be just buying tap water in a plastic bottle as compared to taking out of the tap, or they believing based on the name of a company that it appears to be, at least by label, to be spring water when it in fact isn't?
Mr. Chair, yes. The issue about municipal water system or community water system, if that type of a system is used, it is required to be on the principal display panel as part of the name of the food.
In principal display panel, is that individual bottles or is that just on the front of the shelf that the bottled water may be stacked on?
Mr. Chair, the principal display panel is the part that normally faces the customer that is normally displayed on a shelf. So it would be on each individual container, on the front of that container, or in some cases, the lid of the container if it's displayed in that type of a manner. For instance, a container of sour cream might have it on the lid or it might have it on the face of the container.
Right, so individual containers should have some type of display.
Yes, sir. Each individual container. So municipal or community water system would have to appear on the principal display panel indicating that it was from a municipal system. Then if that system, that municipal system, drew the water from a spring, they may identify that as spring water and then identify the spring where it came from. It can get... I'll say confusing, and I don't know that I have all the answers, when you have a registered business name or a registered trademark name that includes the word spring. We have asked FDA for interpretation of their regulations on several occasions when we get into those areas, and I don't have all the answers on that.
All right. And do you know what type of requirement, if any, that identification needs to have in the sense of type size, point size?
Mr. Chair, I believe there are requirements for the terms community water system or municipal system. I would be happy to verify this, but I believe what the regulations say is that it can be no smaller than one-half the type size of the name of the food that's there. So if you're calling it bottled water and then you put in the words municipal system, the municipal system can be no more than half the type size of the word bottled water.
All right. And I understand that we as a state have chosen to adopt federal rules, and that's what we are basically working with or under. I shouldn't say under, it's what we've just adopted. That tells me that we have the alternative of not adopting the federal rules and having our own state requirements.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. We can do that. There are some problems with uniformity. Product that is brought in from other states mm-hmm. or product that leaves this state that goes into another state could run into some problems. But yes, sir, we could do that.
Okay. And specifically, I'm going to ask you on the handout that we received, the first page, which is page 522, it talks about the definition, I guess, identity of what bottled water is. And reading that first subpart of one on the description, it talks about such as fluoride may be optionally added within the limitations established under, I guess, some other FERC regulation. Can you elaborate as to what that means in the sense that there's like a threshold, that there's a limit of how much fluoride can be in and it still being called that? Does that mean it doesn't have to be identified as an ingredient or what?
Mr. Chair, fluoride would have to be identified if it was an ingredient in that. To my knowledge, we have no bottled water manufacturers in Oregon that are using fluoride. It is in several or many of the municipal systems. Mm-hmm. But to my knowledge, none of the bottled water firms in Oregon are using it.
Right. So from what you're understanding is that any of these firms that are using municipal water source, they're not using one that includes fluoride?
That's correct, sir.
Okay. And then just below that, it talks about what it does not include as to food ingredients and the labeling, water, carbonated water, disinfected, I guess, water, and filtered, and it goes on. What does that mean? I'm just not sure if I'm understanding what they're saying it does or doesn't include.
Mr. Chair, as I understand these regulations, there are a number of things that are put up that may resemble or appear to be bottled water but are covered in other statutes or other areas. So when we're talking soda water, there is a portion of the Code of Federal Regulations, also in Oregon regulations, that deals with soft drinks or those types of beverages. So a soda water, a tonic water, a sparkling water are covered under different regulations.
And they'd be identified as what they are as compared to being able to say that they are bottled water.
Yes, sir. They
okay. All right. So I guess I'm going to ask you, Mr. McKay, as to what you think this committee should or shouldn't be doing as to making sure to ensure that a consumer has, let's say, adequate notice that when they're buying bottled water, that they know what they're getting.
Mr. Chair, my opinion is if these regulations are enforced, if all of the companies that are bottling water in this state or outside this state and shipping it into Oregon are complying with these regulations, the consumer will know. The question that I have, and I'm sorry I can't answer it right now, is about the business names that some firms operate under.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have an answer for that. I would be more than happy to discuss this with FDA and get back to you on their interpretation on this.
All right. I think that's fair. The one thing I guess I do have an issue with is when I look at some of these bottled labeling, it seems like the size of type that is, let's say, I guess required to give notice to consumers, you almost have to do, as I do now, put on your cheater glasses to actually be able to read it, because you have to magnify it to get it to the point of where you can actually see what it says. So maybe it just goes with age, but at the same time, it just seems to me that I would like for us to consider making certain that it's, you know, say, prominently displayed where someone doesn't have to look for the ultra-fine print as to whether it is or isn't. So I'd like to get some more feedback on that, if possible.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, unless you have anything else that you want to share with us.
Not at this time, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll do it in a second. Okay, and what else? All right. We have one other area. I guess I'll kind of want to go back over what I said at the earlier part of the meeting. The meeting today is basically set up to give us an opportunity to kind of see where we may be focusing on concepts that might be introduced through the committee as committee bills. And I have been working with a couple of, let's say, groups or individuals on maybe some other concepts that haven't come forward. One of the areas that I've been participating in is on the Department of Business and Consumer Services Identity Theft Workforce or Work Group, and it has been ongoing, and I've been monitoring or participating in that to hopefully see if we can get consensus from the broader group that have a lot of different interests being represented as to concepts that could move forward. At the same time, I've been reserving, as we've said at that meeting, that we may see individuals bringing different concepts forward on their own or through other means. And so the chair may be bringing some stuff forward at our next meeting, depending on what happens with, what is the results of the work group's meetings that the DCBS is doing. With that in mind, one of the areas that I've asked for some information, and I'm also working with the Oregon Association of Industries regarding truncating the credit card numbers to make certain that those type of personal information is not being given out or, let's say, accessible to people that might be dumpster diving and stuff like that. So I've asked for just the concept to start being drafted, and Dave Hendricks is here today, and he can probably give us a little bit of information. Now, I want to give the caveat. This is just, let's call it my placeholder as compared to something that I'm moving forward, but it kind of gives me my concept. I've not had a chance to share this with Ms. Brandis, who represents the Association of Oregon Industries, because it's just my understanding it just came off the press this morning. And so I will make sure she gets a copy of that. There's a meeting for the work group this afternoon, and I will get a copy to her, and she and I have been trading phone calls regarding this particular area, because I know she wanted to be checking with her members as to any problems. The last part of this, I will, Ms. Hendricks, come on up. The last part, I've spoken with Ms. Brandis, and I've also spoken with some different retailers, and it's my understanding that the larger card holders such as Visa and MasterCard are now requiring truncation on the receipts that are both kept for the business and those that are going to individual consumers as the machinery or the equipment is being released or new contracts are being entered. So I know that this is something somewhat happening on the national level, to some level, but we're not necessarily sure that's going to take care of or how quickly it's occurring for protection of Oregonians and their identity. So, Mr. Hendricks?
Chair Posansky, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Legislative Council's office. This is just a first shot at this draft. It's not an area I was very familiar with, and when I went back and looked at the statutes that we had There was, in my mind, some confusion about exactly where we were at on this topic, other than there were a couple of very clear things. I believe it was in 2003 that 646887 was passed, and that's the first statute you see here, which basically banned any future sales of equipment that would generate a receipt for the customer that had the full credit card number on it. And I think that was probably the biggest problem that was out there, were those receipts that were put out that actually had the full credit card number on it that could fall into other people's hands. And when you read the statutes that they passed at that point, it seemed to me that what they were trying to do was distinguishing between the customer receipt, the piece of paper you gave to the customer, versus paper records retained by the merchant. It wasn't terribly clear, but I think that those were the two things they were talking about. So the first step they took was to say, well, you can't sell these machines anymore, which meant that eventually the old machines that were out there, the ones that they used to take your card and put it down and mechanically run it, run a carbon copy off of it and give a carbon copy to the customer, those, in theory, there may be some out there, yet I haven't seen one in a long time, but those at least were effectively banned for future sales, but the old ones were still out there and could still be used. With respect to the paper, the ones that were still being generated, they had a second statute. And what you see here in Section 2 is kind of misleading, because it looks like this is a new section of law. Section 2 is actually pretty much a copy of what currently exists in 646888, relating to what happens with copies of, generally of copies. And what it said basically was is that the merchant's copy, to the extent they had one that they kept, paper copy, that they had to get rid of it within 3 years or turn it into a microfilm or microfiche copy. Now, obviously, at this point, we're already talking about old technology. I doubt if there's too many merchants anymore that use microfilm or microfiche. You know, anymore, you scan it in and you put it into your records. So one of the questions that I think are a good question for the committee or the legislature next time around is should you even allow paper records for the merchant? Is that a problem? Does anybody still use them? What Section 2 basically says, if my understanding of the request was to say, we don't want to have paper receipts anymore for either the merchant or the customer. What Section 2 does is give basically a couple more years for people to turn things into microfilm, after which point they'd have to destroy it. If they're not turning them into microfilm anymore, Section 2 may be moot, and it could just drop out and say, look, by 2010, get rid of all paper copies. Beyond that is the question about other records, electronic, et cetera. Those are not really covered by existing law, and I don't know if they're a problem or not. It'd be something else. Obviously, you can't ban all computer copies. The credit card companies need to know the numbers and things, et cetera. If paper copies are the primary problem, they could simply, one of the options would be to just address paper copies and not address electronic. So the one other thing I would mention is there is one other statute out there that was brought to my attention relating to check cashing. It's kind of a related topic, but not directly applied to credit card transactions. But there is another statute out there that allows a merchant to require a customer to give their credit card number as a condition of cashing a check. So I mentioned that. It's there. It's on the books. Whether or not it's, I noticed it in the process of putting this together and thought I'd mention it.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you for giving us that. And like I said, I will be talking to Ms. Brandis and working on this, and we'll decide on whether or not this will move forward. Thank you. I guess at this point, we're pretty well, I think, completed the work that we had as a committee. I am going to go ahead and see if there's anyone here today that wanted to give us any summary as to thoughts as to consumer protection legislation that they would like for us to be considering at this point, knowing that we will have another meeting, and if you have your concepts at that point to move forward, then what I would be suggesting is that you need to be talking to our staff
between now and then so we can at least see whether there's enough support for something to be coming through the committee. So I'll just see if anyone wants to come forward. If they do, raise their hand. If not, then we'll call it a close for the meeting. Not seeing anyone running and rushing up with that committee. Oh, I guess there is one other thing that we do need to talk about. There is a need for one more meeting, and it's probably going to be, I'm thinking, sometime in late November, first of December. And what I'll do, instead of us trying to do that right here on the open record, I'll have staff contact us and see what availability around, knowing that people may have other obligations with work and personal obligations. So with that, thank you very much, and we're adjourned.